third case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Ronald Lewis Tallarico. Thank you. For the appellant is Ms. Sue Ann Dardis, an attorney from Spearfish, South Dakota. For the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Ms. Patricia Archer, Assistant Attorney General. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. This case is brought to you before you on a judgment of conviction that was issued in March of 2001 against Ronald Tallarico. This story, the facts of this case, start when my client, Ronald Tallarico, and Ms. Judy Latkin depart from California in July of 2001. They decide that they're going to go on a road trip. This road trip eventually leads to them being in Sturgis, and two indictments were issued against Ronald Tallarico. One was not appealed, and the second was. However, the cases were consolidated for pretrial motion purposes, but the trials were not. This case, Mr. Tallarico was indicted on two counts of grand theft, three counts of third-degree burglary, and one count of first-degree petty theft. He made continual requests for substitute counsel several months prior to trial, and those requests were denied. On the day of trial, he made a final request for substitute counsel, and that was again denied. Mr. Tallarico was frustrated with the system. He determined that he wasn't going to attend his trial as long as his trial counsel was going to represent him. He stated, "Trial counsel has no authority whatsoever to represent me. Return me to my jail cell. I refuse to try."
Was he unequivocal with respect to his wishes to not participate in the trial?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because at some junctures he would say, "I want to be returned to my jail cell as long as defense counsel will be in the room representing me. If I'm not granted substitute counsel, I don't want to be there." On other occasions he would say, "I want to proceed pro se. I want an opportunity to subpoena my witnesses. I want my counsel to subpoena my witnesses." I don't think it was unequivocal per se.
So if you put yourself in the position of the trial judge, what was he to do?
I think that my issue one, under the laws of the state of South Dakota, he had to compel that defendant to attend the trial initially.
Pro he se had, or with a new attorney or, I mean, your client seems to be a little inconsistent. What did he want?
He wanted substitute counsel. He made that request, I believe, four times several months prior to the trial commencing. He made that request that he proceed pro se. The trial court didn't make the proper inquiries of those. The trial court simply said, when he made his request for substitute counsel, the trial court simply heard what he said and told him, "I gave you experienced attorney. I have seen him in my courtroom before. I believe he's competent. I believe he's provided you effective assistance of counsel, and I think he's going to do it. I know he's going to give it to you in the future."
And he had done this already once before in his prior trial, and everything was fine. Isn't that correct, though? The first time around, he did the same thing, the first trial.
Right. He did request substitute counsel.
And he asked for substitute counsel.
Right.
But then when the judge denied it, the trial went on and it was fine. In fact, he was acquitted, correct?
He was acquitted of one charge, correct.
So what did the trial court do incorrectly this time he was approaching this the same time, the way he did the first trial, isn't that correct?
Correct. I don't necessarily agree with the way he did it in the first trial. He should have conducted, when the defendant makes a request for substitute counsel, he can't simply just listen to what the defendant says. He needs to make an inquiry. He needs to inquire of the defense counsel, "What have you done? Are these allegations true? Did you tell Mr. Tallarico that you would prefer not to represent him?"
Didn't he ask him that, though?
No, he didn't.
Well, he asked Mr. Hubbard, and Mr. Hubbard said that, in his opinion, he could adequately represent him.
Yes. At one stage But on the last day of the on the day that the trial commenced, Mr. Tallarico again made his motion for substitute counsel, and at that point, Mr. Hubbard, he referred to his relationship with his client as a conflict of interest situation. He stated, I think it's going to be difficult to represent this client. He more or less told the court that he didn't want to do it.
He said he didn't want to, but he still said he was able to do it.
Yes.
Let's go back to the in absentia part issue. Is it possible for a defendant to waive presence at a jury trial?
Not initially.
So you're saying there's no way that a defendant can waive their presence at a trial. They have to be at the trial, the beginning of the trial.
In a felony case, yes.
Even if they're threatening to kill a judge, kill a jury, they still got to be there.
Yes.
Well, let me just ask this, though. We know that it's possible to waive your right to a jury trial altogether. You can enter a plea of guilty. As long as you know your three Boykin rights, you can waive your right completely to any jury trial. So why is it not possible to waive your presence at a trial if you can waive the existence of a trial altogether?
Your Honor, I refer back to the strict language that the legislature put before us in 23A-39.1 and 39.2.
But the statutes are full of shalls. You shall have a jury trial, you shall have a jury from your peers and all those things, but all those shalls can be waived. We've said repeatedly that as long as a person is aware of their Boykin rights, they can waive the right to a jury trial. So why is it possible that a person can waive the right to a trial altogether but not waive their right to be present at a trial?
I think to answer that question, you have to look at the reasoning why these statutes are in existence as they are. If a defendant is going to, they compel the presence of the defendant at a trial to ensure that the defendant knows they're being tried.
Well, certainly, in this case, Mr. Tallarico knew he was being tried. This isn't a case where he disappeared and the court went ahead anyway. This isn't what, like some of the cases.
In fact, help me with this part of the record. As I understand it, he appeared the morning of his trial, and they were doing pretrial motions.
Correct.
And his disappearance, or absence, I guess is a better word, occurred after he had appeared at the time and place set for his trial.
Correct.
What rights are vindicated by dragging him in the courtroom, counting to 10, and say, okay, he appeared in front of the jury, now get him out of here because that's what he wants, versus what happened here where they had him in the building and he's threatening to spit on the jurors and demands to be taken back to his cell prior to the jury being brought in? What is the difference?
Your Honor, I think defendants are granted few constitutional rights, and one of these rights is embodied in these statutes. You
have spit on the jury?
No, Your Honor. I do believe, actually, though, that he didn't say I'd spit on the jury, but he said I'll spit on my defendant, if that makes any difference.
Now, you just said something. I'm sorry. Did you finish your answer?
Yeah.
You just said something that intrigued me. You said the defendant is entitled to constitutional rights, but as I understand it, you're arguing a statutory right here, not
That's
a constitutional right. Okay.
You're correct.
There are ways of assuring his behavior to a certain extent, are there not? Were any of those taken? I mean, for instance, I know from some of my experience, they will bring spitters in with a hood. Now, was any of this contemplated at this point, or any kind of shackles or anything of that nature discussed on the record?
In fact, Your Honor, if you look at the first case, the first trial, the trial court did in fact place the defendant in chains during voir dire for the first portion of voir dire. So this trial court knew how to restrain a difficult defendant. It had contemplated the spit hood, shackling, restraining, and it's also contemplated putting the stun belt on him. So he did know how to deal with a difficult client.
Why didn't they do some of that morning, you know?
I think they should have.
Well, the stun belt they couldn't do because he apparently had some kind of a heart
that
condition.
Yeah. I think under the rules of statutory construction, these statutes need to be, the language within is just clear and unambiguous. The exception, there is an exception that I think is noteworthy, that in misdemeanor cases, they can waive these, and that is a statutory exception. The legislature could have made that apply to felony cases, but chose not to do so. And if this court were to determine that a criminal defendant did not have to appear initially at trial, it would circumvent the language within 39-2.
Even how would you define initially? He was actually there at the beginning of the trial, was he not?
He was at a pretrial hearing. He was not at the commencement of the trial. This court in State v. Schlagwaiver defined the commencement of the trial. It said the trial commences when the jury is impaneled, or when the work of the impaneling of the jury begins.
That's for double jeopardy purposes. The purpose of this statute isn't for double jeopardy. Shouldn't the distinction be drawn?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think we need to be consistent in how we define the commencement of the trial.
Aren't you overlooking the use of the word or by the legislature? Where they say, in non-capital cases, voluntarily absents himself after the trial has commenced, or two, engages in conduct which justifies his being excluded from the courtroom. Isn't that what happened just prior to trial?
No, Your Honor, because that subsection 2 is still, you still have to comply with the preceding language, the further progress of a trial. To and including the return of a verdict shall not be prevented whenever a defendant who initially appears, who is initially present. So in order for that subsection 2 to kick in, the defendant still has to be initially present.
Article 6, Section 6 of the South Dakota Constitution says the right of trial by jury shall remain inviolate. Yet, as Justice Konenkamp has pointed out, even though it doesn't say in this provision, we've held repeatedly that can be waived.
True.
So why can't they waive the provision of this statute?
I think, Your Honor, because the legislature took measures.
Does it say in there this cannot be waived? Are those words in there?
No, Your Honor, they're not.
Well, they're not in the Constitution either, are they?
No.
Sometimes the courts look to the purpose of a statute to determine what the legislature intended. What do you think the purpose of the statute is here that you're relying upon?
Well, I think the purpose of that statute was addressed in Crosby v. U.S., which I cited in my brief, and they did a pretty meticulous job of going through the history. They went through the language, the history, and the logic of Rule 43. They wanted to make sure that defendants were aware of when their trial was going to commence. They wanted to make sure that the expenses of a trial were not maximized by a defendant leaving in the middle of the trial.
Well, weren't those purposes then fulfilled here? Because this man did know that there was going to be a trial. I mean, if the purpose of this statute is to protect his rights, weren't the purposes fulfilled in this case? This isn't a case where...
As it applies to this case, one of the purposes might have been.
I mean, this isn't a case where someone's disruptive in the judge's opinion, and the judge says, that's it, you're out of here, you're not going to be here for the rest of your trial, and the person's involuntarily forced out. This is a case where the judge is trying his best to uphold this man's rights, and he's saying, I don't want to be here, believe me, I don't know why you're not listening to me, I don't want to be here, I'm not going to be here. And if you make me be here, I'm going to make it miserable. Not just for you, not just for my lawyer, I'm going to make life miserable for the citizens who come in to serve as jurors. And so, I mean, what purpose has been defeated here?
I think one of the purposes is that they're allowed to waive their right to be present during their trial once the trial commences. They're not able to waive it prior to the commencement of the trial. And that's because if a defendant absconds or refuses to appear for his trial prior to its commencement, then the judicial coffers are limited versus him absconding during the middle of the trial. There is one other issue that I would like to address rather quickly. I know I cited 9 of them, but 2 I think are rather dispositive, the first and the seventh, which deals with whether the trial court erred in denying defense counsel's motion for a judgment of acquittal. And the rule in this is governed by 23A-22-8. The criminal conviction is not supportable based on the uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice. The corroboration must tend to connect the defendant with the commission of the offense. Corroboration is not sufficient if it merely shows the commission of the offense or the circumstances thereof. In this case, Judy Latkin testified, and she was, as a matter of law, determined to be the accomplice. If you exclude all of her testimony to determine whether it was corroborated or not, there is very little left. There is nothing that tends to connect the defendant to the commission of these crimes. What is left is you have testimony from 3 witnesses that say their tools were stolen. You have testimony from some officers who said they made some investigation, but they never talked to Mr. Chalarico. They never took any fingerprints, footprints, photographs. You also have some testimony from a pawnbroker that said Judy Latkin pawned some items.
But what about the testimony with his name on the pawn receipts and his identification by at least one of the pawn shop people of having pawned the property, the stolen property at issue?
But does that tend to connect him to the commission of the crimes? Does that tend to connect him to the burglary? I would submit it doesn't. It might tend to connect him to possession of stolen property, but certainly not to the commission of the crime. And in fact, the state brought that up as part of their argument that you could make an inference, it was circumstantial evidence that whomever pawned the item actually stole the item. Well, Ms. Latkin pawned the laser alignment system, but Mr. Tallarico was convicted for that. She pawned the air compressor, but he was convicted of it. There's nothing whatsoever, once you exclude Judy Latkin's testimony, to tend to connect Mr. Tallarico to the crime, to the commission of the crime.
Well, it connects it, but it's just not as direct as you think is necessary, right?
I don't even think it connects it to the commission of the crime, to him committing third-degree burglary. I don't think that connects the two at all.
When you look at all the testimony, and the two of them are out there together, and then they end up with, as you say, stolen property, and then one of them pawns one thing, one of them pawns the other. Isn't that at least some indirect connection to the fact of the burglary?
A burglary was committed.
Well, we know from other evidence that a burglary was committed because
right.
The property was gone. So,
I did some comparison of other state law on this area, and in State v. Oldhausen, that defendant was charged with the possession of controlled substance. Once they excluded the accomplice testimony, they found $416 cash on his person along with cocaine in his vehicle within his arm's reach. That was corroborating evidence, obviously. In State v. Filey, it was the first degree robbery. In excluding the accomplice testimony, you had a victim's description of the robber. You had testimony from witnesses that chased the defendant and his brother after the robbery occurred. That was corroborating. In State v. Nelson, you had a grand theft. In excluding the accomplice testimony, you had a witness who saw the defendant unhook a stolen trailer on her property. We had also a witness who saw the defendant remove a metal plate and stickers from his pocket when he was arrested, but before he was placed in the police vehicle. That was enough corroborating evidence. In State v. Dominick, you had a conspiracy to possess and distribute controlled substance. And that is similar to this case in that he just had a chemist who tested the drugs. Yes, they were in fact drugs. Yes, in fact, they were stolen tools. And a police officer who arrested the accomplice. And this court determined that is not enough corroborating evidence on accomplice's testimony. I also addressed a motion for a substitute counsel and whether that it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to deny Mr. Talrico an abuse of, deny him his motion. And with that rule, you have to show an irreconcilable dispute regarding strategy or defense. And there, he made four requests. The trial court simply said, this is a ploy. You're trying to manipulate the system. However, each of his requests were either denied, they were denied, or some of them were just put off. They weren't, he didn't want to make a ruling at that time. He reserved his right to make a ruling later.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Barcher, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. It is the state's position this morning that there were no individual errors nor cumulative error warranting reversal in this case. Counsel wasn't able to get through all the issues, and I'm sure I won't either. I obviously will rely on the arguments and authorities presented in my brief. I would like to talk about the first issue, the trial in absentia. First off, I would disagree with counsel with regard to the inquiry whether the defendant's request to be absent at his trial was unequivocal. I think a clear reading of that transcript, and there were several pages of dialogue between the court and the defendant, reveals that he decided he did not want to be at his trial.
Sergeant, normally when the court determines whether someone's waived their right to a jury trial or whatever, there's a clear set of questions that the court will go through in canvassing the defendant to determine whether or not they actually voluntarily and knowingly waived that right. Was that present here? I don't think the court ever concluded anything about voluntariness or knowing, the knowingly and voluntarily waiving that right to be present at the trial.
It may not have occurred all at the on the morning of trial, because I think it had occurred earlier. If you recall, in the hearing on January 7, which was prompted by his initial request for new counsel, after he refused to see his attorney when he tried visiting him in the jail, they had a hearing on January 7, and at that point,
before the first trial,
correct, and that is when he had the violent outburst and the cursing and everything else, which prompted his removal from that hearing, actually, and then they had to. When he settled down, they brought him back in later that afternoon. And the judge went through a whole litany of discussion about his right to be, I believe it was at that hearing or another hearing, I specifically recall the discussion by the court about the defendant's right to be present.
Is that in this record?
Yes. I believe it's in the January 7 hearing, because I know he quoted the basically the language from Illinois v. Allen, which is a United States Supreme Court decision that talks about the court being able to remove him if he's causing a disturbance and that kind of thing.
But he did not waive his right on the first trial, correct?
That's correct.
The judge would not have to repeat this for the second trial?
Well, if you... The January 7 hearing, and actually probably all the pretrial hearings, were joint hearings for purposes of both cases. And there was a discussion. In fact, the court, you know, told the defendant, look, you can absent yourself, you know, but everything, the whole justice system is kind of geared for you being here. You have the right to confront witnesses. You have the right to have a jury. You know, the court told him these things. He said, but... If you, and he gave him the warning that's required under Illinois v. Allen. He said, if you continue to act this way and cause the kind of disturbance that we saw, and I think it was the January 7th hearing in the afternoon, he said, if you cause the kind of disturbance that we saw earlier, I will have you removed. And I think he talked also about the possibility, the other options the court was concerned about, as far as, you know, what can we do if he does cause a disturbance? You know, we can bind and gag you if we have to.
His main concern here was his lawyer, correct?
And
there's some discussion on whether he should have been allowed to proceed pro se.
Very minimal discussion on that, yes. I mean, there was one slight reference, and it was, again, it was on the morning of trial, the second trial, the February 26th trial that we're here today. And when it looked like the court was going to deny his request for substitute counsel, he basically said then, okay, fine, then give me a continuance, and I'll subpoena my witnesses, and I will I'll represent myself. And that was the only reference he had ever made at any time throughout these proceedings about appearing pro se. And it was never restated, reaffirmed, and in fact, it was, you know, he negated it later, later that morning, in fact, when the court had the deputy inquire of the defendant about his seriousness of that option. And frankly, you know, the defendant had, after he said, I want to be back to my jail. And if you make me stay, things are going to get ugly. And so after he left, the court and counsel realized, you know, we didn't really approach this option about representing yourself. We need to do that. And so the court sent Deputy Wiltz, who apparently had established some kind of rapport with this man, as best as any of the jailers could, sent him over there to talk to him and ask him if he was willing to come back to court to have this discussion about representing himself, even though he had already said he didn't want to be in the trial at all. And that's when he told Deputy Wiltz, well, I don't want to go back. You can't make me, and if you do, it will get ugly. So at that point, Deputy Wiltz just asked him, do you want to represent yourself? And that's when he said, no, I need an attorney. I'm not, you know, I can't do this. So he wanted an attorney, but he wanted, you know, to pick and choose. And that's certainly not the standard for establishing a need for substitute counsel.
Your comments have muddied the water for me on one issue. Was the request to proceed pro se conditioned on the right to subpoena these other witnesses or on the right to ask for a new attorney?
I didn't read it as conditional upon he just said, and I believe this was the quote, you can either give me a week's continuance and subpoena my witnesses and I'll represent myself, or send me back to my cell. And that was, like, say, after he had established on the morning of his trial, up until the morning of his trial, frankly, we hadn't heard anything from him since the end of his first trial about his dissatisfaction with Mr. Hubbard. In fact, you know, he allowed Mr. Hubbard to represent him through the first trial, and that he was acquitted on the felonies. He allowed Mr. Hubbard to file motions on his behalf. They had a motion hearing in this case 1 week prior to this trial, and we didn't hear anything from the defendant about his concerns about the representation of Mr. Hubbard. It was only on the morning of trial, when he found out the day before that Mr. Hubbard had not subpoenaed this witness that he wanted so badly. And Mr. Hubbard did, in fact, explain to the court. The court did make inquiry of Mr. Hubbard as to the witness issue. And you have to kind of separate this, because the reasons that were given by the defendant earlier as to why he wanted substitution of counsel, frankly, didn't establish any justifiable reason, as case law has determined. But those are not the same reasons he gave. On the morning of trial, the reason he gave was that Mr. Hubbard had not subpoenaed his witness.
Shifting gears for a minute, looking at the statute on issue one, why does shall not mean shall?
Well, again, I think that statutes like the Constitution, it sets out the minimum. I mean, this is what we expect. And there is this right of a defendant to be present at certain critical proceedings of aspects of his proceeding.
But it doesn't say he has a right to be there. He says it shall be there.
He shall be there. Well, and the state's position is that despite the shall language, and we've seen shall language in numerous other statutes in our code, the court has in the past adopted exceptions. And we allow defendants to waive. Again, the right is his. It's a personal right to him. And the court has said, you're allowed to waive personal rights.
What about then this U.S. Supreme Court decision? How do you distinguish that?
Well, Crosby is distinguishable, frankly, on its facts and limited to its facts. Yes, it was analyzing Rule 43B, or A and B. But the Crosby decision itself, and as the court stated in its issue statement, was whether Federal Rule 43 permits the trial in absentia of a defendant who absconds prior to trial and is absent at its beginning. We don't have anything near that situation in this case. And the court, even in its analysis, even though it went through the whole legislative intent behind Rule 43, its focus and its concern clearly was on the fact that in that case, there was an inferred waiver of the defendant's right through his conduct. He'd absconded prior to trial, and they held the trial without him. So the court was concerned, how do we know that this was a voluntary absence?
And you're saying there was an express waiver here.
Here we have an express waiver. We have the defendant standing in front of the court. The trial is starting. I mean, it is trial day. Everybody's there. The lawyers are there. The judge is there. The jury's waiting in the next room. And he knows that this trial is starting.
Not the jury, but the prospective jurors are waiting in the next room.
Excuse me, yes,
right.
The prospective jurors.
And of course, the statute contemplates that there actually would be the selection of the jury. That's the beginning of a trial. Not the assembly of prospective jurors, but the actual selection of the jury is the beginning of the trial, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. The statute doesn't speak or doesn't define what it means by commencement of trial or what does initially present mean. And I think that, as I cited in my brief, and I think there is support, case law authority, for the interpretation that for purposes of Rule 43, commencement of trial may include the gathering that everybody is having to start the trial.
These are these out-of-state cases that looked at Rule 43 and interpreted commencement a little bit differently.
They have interpreted commencement under facts very well, in the Ruiz decision, identical to the case at bar. And again, they were struggling with the same issue. What do you do when you have a defendant who shows up for the preliminary, you know, everyone's showing up for trial. It's trial day. There's always preliminary matters to take care of. And you tell the court, I don't want to participate. The distinction between commencement of trial, as this court has interpreted for purposes of double jeopardy, is different from the definition of commencement of trial that I'm advocating today. And there are reasons for that. The policy reasons behind double jeopardy is to protect the defendant. Once that jury is empowered, is sworn, it is empowered to convict him. And there's a vested right, firmly, deeply rooted right, in that defendant having the jury that was selected. And that case law has been established. Crist v. Bretz, U.S. Supreme Court case, talks about that. We don't have that kind. In addition, that is also a right that's rooted in the Constitution. With Rule 43, number one, it's a statutory right. And the policy behind Rule 43, specifically the exception we're talking about, that involves the commencement language, is to make sure this defendant's waiver, or not waiver, but his absence is voluntary. I mean, that's really what we're boiling down to, is what was his absence voluntary, and how do we know it's so? Well, we know it's so because he said it. He was there in person telling the court after the court inquired of him. So, and that's why, for that reason also, I think that the court, this court, could choose to adopt that kind of interpretation for purposes of Rule 43, and it would not be a stretch, because there are the difference. You know, we have a defendant who is physically present and ready. Everybody's ready for the trial to start. But aside from that, I believe that clearly it is a statutory right that the defendant is free to waive, just as this court has said defendants may freely waive other statutory rights, which also have very, quote, clear and unambiguous language, such as the 180-day rule. And, you know, that language also says, prosecution, you shall try this defendant within 180 days, or the case is dismissed. I mean, there's nothing, you know, it didn't say anything about waiver. And what the court said in State v. Bainin was, we understand that. However, we're going to adopt this common law theory of waiver because it fits the needs. And I'm saying that is no different than what we have here, and no different than what the court has done, or what in practice trial courts allow defendants to do all the time.
How close was his departure to jail from the time set for the beginning of the trial?
You mean initially to bring him over that morning, you mean?
Well, they brought him over, and then he went back.
Right.
Right, and how soon did he depart in relation to the time set for the beginning of the trial?
I can only go by the times that were presented on the transcript by the court reporter, but I believe the cover page says 8:30 in the morning, I think, the matters began, and I believe it was about 45 minutes later that they, you know, it took them about 45 minutes to deal with this issue, and then he departed.
And then the trial was to begin at 10 or 9?
Well, again, I don't have the transcript up here, but I believe the court reporter indicated that the proceedings of voir dire started, I think, roughly about 9:30. So I don't know. I don't know anywhere in the record where it said, you know, in the pretrial, you know, housekeeping matters that the judge said, okay, trial starts at 8:30. But we all know, I mean, we all know the jury's waiting. They're getting their instructions, and in the meantime, counsel and defendant and the judges are taking care of the preliminary matters that always have to be taken care of first out of the presence of the jury. So for purposes, you know, I think for most of us, we would say this was trial day, this was game day, and everybody was there, suited up, ready to go.
Can we switch gears and go to the corroboration question, because your time is running out?
Yes.
Tell me, what evidence connects this defendant to the burglaries?
Well,
aside from the accomplice testimony.
Aside from the accomplice testimony, that frankly, the state feels that there's pretty significant direct corroborative evidence in the testimony of the pawn shop owners and the pawn receipts.
Right. And what is that?
Well, we have pawn receipts that have the defendant's name, address, and signature. We have the pawn shop owner for the Spearfish pawn shop, where the defendant pawned the miter saw, who made an in-court, unequivocal positive ID of the defendant as being the man who pawned that saw. And the pawn shop owner from Rapid City, where defendant pawned the saw and the stand, who testified in court that he was fairly certain that was the defendant in making his in-court ID. And in addition to that, we had also a pawn shop receipt with the name, similar name, address, and signature as the one in the other pawn shop. And if you look at those exhibits, there's no question.
What about the air compressor count, though? What is there to tie up? What corroboration is the air compressor count?
Well, and that's true. We don't have in-court identification of him bringing that in. What we have, though, is the testimony of Ms. Lakin. And
well, aside from the accomplice testimony.
But some of the case law that I've found and presented in my brief establishes, number one, and contrary to counsel's argument, the defendant's conduct after his crime, corroborative evidence of the defendant's conduct after his crime, i.e., here, pawning these items, undoubtedly, can help support the conviction for the crime itself. So counsel is arguing, well, we don't have any evidence that that he committed the burglaries. However, the fact he was in possession of stolen property and pawned those items can infer that he was actually involved in the crimes, and there's case law cited for that proposition. As to the other items where we don't have an identification of him as being the person pawning, there's also case law I've cited, which says if the witness, the accomplice witness, is corroborated in other areas, you know, significantly corroborated in these areas, you can and is shown basically to be telling the truth, which is the whole purpose behind having corroborative evidence, you can assume that she's telling the truth as to other matters. And our standard on corroborative evidence doesn't require every material fact to be proven independently of the accomplice. So if you can say she's telling the truth over here, and how do we know that? Well, because we've got these pawn shop owners who are independent third parties with no connection, identifying the defendant as being the person. If she's telling the truth about that, we can assume she's telling the truth about the other one where we don't have the pawn receipts. So I've cited those cases in my brief, and I think they are dispositive to that issue.
You're saying you can use the accomplice's testimony if it's an indication, if there's an indication that she's telling the truth?
Well, if you look at the whole purpose behind the need for corroborative evidence, and I think one of the cases, the People v. Maldonado case out of out of California. So the policy behind corroboration is to avoid the evil of having an accused being convicted by somebody who's also involved in the crime and had a motive, if you will, to set the person up.
Right, so you're saying that this doesn't just tie him to the crime of receiving stolen property, but goes back and then ties him to the burglary, even though there's no testimony whatsoever about anybody being at the burglary.
No.
When we don't know who stole it in, if you eliminate her testimony.
No, we don't have any eyewitnesses placing defendant at the scene. No, we don't. However, we obviously have this accomplice testimony, and the reason we can believe her and the reason that we can tie the defendant to the burglaries themselves, not just the stolen property, is because of she's been shown to be truthful as to these other aspects. She's been shown that, you know, there's sufficient evidence that says she's telling the truth about their activities.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Dardis, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to pick up where Ms. Archer left off. As far as the accomplice testimony goes, you still have to have some corroborating evidence that tends to connect the defendant to the commission of the crime. And the fact that he pawned two of the stolen items does not tend to connect him to the commission of the crime.
She's arguing, as I understand it, that there doesn't have to be a direct connection to the burglary. There can be an indirect connection, or you can infer from that maybe he, you know, that he had stolen the items and then pawned them. You argue with her cases in that respect?
Yes, Your Honor. She did cite not the state, and there the law, that's a Georgia Court of Appeals case, and there the law provides that there only needs to be a slight evidence of corroboration that's required. Here, our South Dakota law says that the corroboration must tend to connect the defendant with the commission of the crime.
Well, it tends to, you know, and then maybe we're quarreling with words about direct or indirect. We have no eyewitness to the burglary, but if he, shortly after the robberies, if he pawned these items, and that's pretty solid from the pawnbroker's testimony, isn't that some evidence tending to connect him to? It doesn't have to be absolutely solid evidence. Isn't that some evidence tending to connect him to the burglary?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it tends to connect him to the possession of stolen property, but it doesn't tend to connect him to the actual event of committing third-degree burglaries. I think there needs to be more in the state's case. There wasn't sufficient. Like this court has said, corroboration is not sufficient if it merely shows the commission of the offense or the circumstances thereof.
But it shows beyond that he's in possession of the stolen item.
Yes. Yes. One pawnbroker did make an in-court identification, the other pawnbroker did not. But if you used her argument, she's saying if someone is in possession of stolen property and goes to pawn it, then you can infer that that person stole it.
You can infer they had possession of it, and it was stolen prior to them coming into possession.
But what you're saying is that the possession could be innocent. She could have committed the burglary and given the property to him and asked him to pawn it, and he could be completely innocent and unknowing that it was stolen.
Absolutely.
Isn't that really a jury call then? Was possession innocent or not innocent?
I don't think the... I'm sorry. Just really nervous.
We don't bite.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Would it be probable cause? Would possession of stolen property be probable cause that they may have committed a burglary?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Well, then let me ask you this. if a magistrate was presented with an affidavit requesting a search warrant, and the probable cause is the standard, and the officer identified that a burglary had occurred and that the stolen property was in John Smith's home, wouldn't that be adequate probable cause to get a search warrant?
In that situation, probably.
Well, then, what's the difference here? Probable cause tends to connect, doesn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I agree with Justice Kornenkamp. The possession could have been innocent. It doesn't connect him. His possession, as testified by the pawnbrokers, it doesn't connect him to the burglaries.
Isn't it almost unrealistic, though, to assume that someone who's out there pawning several items shortly after burglaries had no connection? I mean, is that the leap of faith we're supposed to make on the presumption of innocence, that there's no connection? I mean, what are the chances of the average Joe Blow coming into possession of all this stolen property and then pawning it the next day?
I think it's just a case-by-case basis. Depends on the facts of the case.
Okay, what's your argument as to her? She's saying that as to the corroborating witness, who is an accomplice, that if there's other evidence that tends to make her testimony believable, then you can use it to corroborate the testimony in relation to the crime. Do you have anything in particular on that?
I think that this witness in particular was highly motivated to place the blame at somebody else's feet.
Well, maybe she's highly motivated, but is she trustworthy if what she has to say is corroborated by all the pawnbrokers?
So she says, yeah, these items were pawned, and the pawnbrokers say, yes, they were. She could have gave those items to the defendant to pawn. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she knew they were going to be pawned.
She didn't testify to that, did she?
I don't think so.
No. I mean, she testified that he stole them.
That they both did it.
Right, that they both burglarized the places and took them.
Right. Right.
Well, there is an instruction I know from years ago that the jury could be told that recent possession of stolen property can give rise to an inference that the person knew it was stolen. But even if he knew it was stolen, that wouldn't prove he committed a burglary necessarily, would it? It would only prove that he knew he had received stolen property.
Correct. Well, and not only that, if you take that inference one step further, Judy Lapkin was the one that was in possession of the laser transit and the air compressor. She's the one that pawned those, but Ronald Tallarico was the one that was convicted for those crimes. The state also tries to attempt to distinguish Crosby v. United States in the first issue, and I would just like to address that quickly. Crosby v. United States was a case that involved the defendant absconding from prior to a trial, and the trial was commenced in his absence. And the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, went through and examined the logic and the history and the language of Rule 43, the federal counterpart, which is identical to our state portion, or our state statutes, and they held that supported a straightforward interpretation that prohibits the trial in absentia of a defendant who is not present at the beginning of trial. They very easily could have limited that holding to a defendant who absconds prior to trial. But they didn't. And to try to attempt to say that that was only restricted based on the factual situation of that case ignores that they went through the history and the logic and the language behind the rule. You'd have to disregard everything they said about that to come up with a different conclusion. One other issue I would like to touch on is that of the instruction on specific intent.
Counsel, we have a rule here that if it has not been argued the first two times, you can't bring it up on rebuttal because it's not fair to her. She doesn't get another run at you. Okay?
Sorry about that.
Let's go back to the absentia question. I know your position is that it was not waived. But let's assume for the sake of argument that it could have been waived. Didn't the court properly advise this defendant sufficient so that if it could have been waived, it was waived? And if not, right, I mean, what would the court have needed to say to this man to allow him to waive? And did the court do those things in this case?
I think the court should have pursued whether his request was a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent waiver. Although, I disagree that you can even waive it prior to the commencement of trial.
But I was just asking you to assume that you could waive it. Did he adequately waive it here? That's the question. And
I don't think so. Like the state said, possibly that inquiry was conducted at the beginning of the first trial, but it wasn't conducted here at the beginning of the second trial or prior to the commencement of the second trial.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. We will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Yep, take your stuff, Steve.
You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com.